how does one discern what is the truth, what is fake news? How do you not amplify information that is misinformation or disinformation? How do you communicate with others in civil and respectful ways and negotiate differences of perspective respectfully?
Hello, and a hearty welcome to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack, Executive Director of Cambridge Forum, and we have an ample agenda for you today. Can we resist the hijacking of democracy in America and beyond? In the past decade, we have witnessed the gradual and steady erosion of democratic values, a growing lack of respect for democratic institutions and process, both within the United States and beyond. Hate crimes abound, lies deliberately stoke division between right and left. An unprecedented attack on the US Capitol last January unnerved the nation as images of insurrection whizzed around the world, challenging America's image as the enduring symbol of freedom, equality, and justice. Well, to help us make sense of the political quagmire in which we find ourselves, we have a meeting of three great minds today. John Shattuck and Sushma Raman are co-authors of a new book, Holding Together, Why Our Rights Are Under Siege and How to Reclaim Them for Everyone. And thirdly, our moderator today will be Archon Fung, Professor of Citizenship and Self-Government at the Harvard Kennedy School. And now I'm going to hand over to Archon.
Let's start with the United States. John, you wrote with our colleague Catherine Sickink an article in Foreign Policy that was about the US practicing what it preaches abroad, but practicing it at home. So I think it's very easy to cheer I certainly am very much cheering on the Biden administration, as are many Democrats and Republicans alike. It's one of the few issues in our time in which there seems to be some bipartisan consensus, and that's about Russia and the invasion. But you and Catherine kind of turn it around and say, fine, it's easy to do that. Might be a little bit harder to walk the democracy and human rights and rights walk at home. So what are the ways in which we need to do better at home?
Well, in all ways. We have, the biggest democracy crisis that all of us who are in the United States are facing right now is right here at home. And many of our democratic institutions are broken. We've seen gridlock. We have polarization. We have a massive amount of unfinished business that has been put before the Congress that the Biden administration is trying to pursue. So there's a great deal of work to be done. And the United States is both weakened from a national security standpoint and being able to promote soft power overseas if it has a democracy crisis at home. And it, above all, needs to be true to itself. And this is really what our book is about, because the book is about a search for the values that can hold the country together. And what are those values? Well, it turns out the values really are the values of human rights and responsibilities, very much parallel with that. That's what Catherine and I wrote in our article, responsibilities to respect the rights of others. But in a country as diverse as the United States, unprecedented diversity, the thing that will hold it together is respect for rights. Now, in order to find out how Americans today feel about their rights, we did a great deal of polling. We did public opinion polling in several different dimensions. We did some at the very beginning of the pandemic, and then we did some just very recently last year. And remarkably and overwhelmingly, we found that Americans, at least at a very high level, have a very strong commitment to human rights at home, to their rights, and not only to their rights, but also to their responsibilities as citizens. One of the findings in our poll was that 80% of Americans across the political spectrum, including Republicans and independents as well as Democrats, said that without our rights, America is nothing. And Americans have more in common than many people think. Now, that was a surprise. We were surprised ourselves to get that result. And of course, this is at odds with the polarization that we see all around us. But when we dug down a little deeper in the polling, we found actually there are rays of possibility of bridging political divisions. For example, we found that a majority of Americans agree that civil rights should be balanced with civic responsibilities. 8 out of 10 Americans agree that personal freedom should be balanced against a responsibility to keep people safe in a pandemic. We asked very specifically the question basically about what you would do to make sure that the society at large could be kept safe. And most people agreed with the masking and the other approaches that were being taken. Not everybody, but certainly 8 out of 10. On a very different topic, 8 out of 10 Americans agree that the police can protect the public from crime while also being held accountable for violations of civil rights. A very important finding. 80% basically said that the police should be held accountable, even though they could do their jobs while being held accountable. So I think we found that a majority of Americans really reject the culture wars that are being fought at the political extremes, because they don't live at the extremes. They live across the broad political center. 72% agreed that they're fed up with polarization, that politicians are intentionally dividing our country, and that they should work together to find solutions to the country's problems. So, you know, in the bottom line here is that we found a remarkable degree, not only of agreement about rights in general, but agreement about particular rights. And about 70 to 80% of the country, at least at a very high level, have that kind of commitment. So there is what I would call a silent majority of Americans, using a phrase that was popular back in the era of Richard Nixon, but I think it's true again today, a silent majority that supports an expansive view of rights and responsibilities. And then a very activist, a much more active than the silent majority, minority that is working to prevent the country from coming together. And this is, to be rather specific about it, based on our polling, this is an active minority made up of mostly white constituency motivated by fear. A fear that, and they deny the rights of others that they regard as threats to their racial, cultural, or political dominance. And this is a deep underlying concern and condition as demography changes. However, 70% or 80% as part of this silent majority strongly support racial equality, equal rights, equal justice. And I think it's important to recognize that. So that's what our book found and what we put before the readers. And I think it's important. We're not unrealistic about this. We don't suggest that this is immediately going to transform the country, but we have found the values that are the values that could hold the country together.
So there's been a very recent news event. Probably a lot of people in the audience looked at the Politico leak about Samuel Alito, Justice Alito's draft opinion on abortion that would overturn Roe v. Wade if it turns out to be the court's ruling. What do you think about the Supreme Court's decision that seems, by the period from Roe to yesterday, basically, quite different from the constitutional law as it stood, and then also maybe quite different from public opinion?
So this is shocking, but also not surprising. And it also connects to a range of other rights. So, you know, we don't lead single issue lives. Somebody today on Twitter posted who was, whose son actually was killed in a school shooting, that, you know, if people were actually concerned about the lives of children, they would really think about how to, you know, get rid of gun violence, but we've not been able to tackle the issue of gun violence in a meaningful way. You know, similarly, if you look at the history of, you know, the ways in which women's bodies have been controlled, we've had forced sterilizations, for example, in the past. We've had a history of enslavement that really has, you know, degraded African-American women's bodies. So I think that this is really a shocking development, but I'm also hopeful that this could result in people galvanizing to say that reproductive rights and justice are important to a good society.
I just want a footnote to Sushma's comment, which I agree with. What we found in our poll is, again, both hopeful and a bit surprising. 72% of Americans, bipartisan across the board, including 55% of Republicans, so more than a majority of Republicans, support a woman's right to make decisions about her body and her personal life. And that's very fundamental. So if 72% of Americans are of that point of view, the Supreme Court is completely out of touch with the reality, to say nothing of the fact that it's in the process of overturning a half a century of law, and highly disruptive and certainly deeply damaging to people of limited means and people of color who are going to be searching in vain for ways of exercising what 72% of Americans think is a constitutional right.
And so we often think of the court, or in past decades have thought of the court as the protector of rights. Kind of your survey results leave me with this puzzle that so many Americans agree on the importance of many of these priorities. That's number one. Number two is they feel like these priorities are not secure, from free speech to voting to racial equality to certainly to quality education and clean air and water. They're afraid that they might not be able to enjoy these things. And yet none of the branches of politics, of our political institutions, seem on board with these very high measures that of what people want. So what's the problem?
You know, I think we have some real structural issues here, and they ought to be put on the table. We have a dysfunctional U.S. Senate, and the Senate is dysfunctional in fundamental ways because it can't operate as a majority institution, which most legislative bodies do. So it can't reflect the view of the people because there are filibuster opportunities. We have a Supreme Court with lifetime appointments, which we've had for a long time now. But it turns out, I think, that what happens, particularly as people go onto the court, is that you really need to have some refreshment that brings new people on. Now, of course, what's happened recently is a variety of new people have come on the court who passed a very specific litmus test to the president who nominated them, which is whether they would overturn Roe versus Wade. And so there are plenty of examples, I think, of the politicization of the court. So these institutional structural questions are very much part of the disconnect between public opinion on the one hand, which is favorable to rights, and the public policies that are emerging.
Sushma, do you? Yeah, you look like you're about to add.
So I would just add to say that rights is secured through hard work, through collective mobilization, through putting pressure on institutions that often will reflect the perspectives of the powerful. And, the law just does not always equal justice. There have been Supreme Court decisions that frankly were ones that we look back in history and say they were the wrong ones. The fight to end slavery, the fight for women's emancipation, all of these involved the mobilization of people on the ground to demand changes for the better, for more inclusiveness. And I think this could be a moment where we see more people coming together to try and advocate for such changes.
I want to go now to some specific rights. You look at many, many rights, and the book deals with a large scope, which is one of its real virtues, one of its many real virtues. But if you were to nominate one or two rights, maybe I'll give each of you an opportunity to nominate one that you think is particularly important to turn the ship around, in which large majorities have these priorities, but the political institutions, our democracy, is not delivering. What is the right? a right that you'd urge Americans to really focus on and try to vindicate at this point so that we can start to turn things around? John, and then Sushma.
I think voting rights would be at the top of my list. And indeed, it's not by accident that they're the first topic that's taken up in the book. We had, for a while, we had a president who was following what I would call the insurrectionist model of democracy, which is, you know, if you win the vote, that's fine. And then you go ahead and govern. If you lose the vote, you don't accept the result. And you certainly don't have a peaceful transfer of power. And that is the most dangerous thing for any democracy to have that. So I think voting rights, and very specifically, efforts to stop voter suppression, to adopt national standards for voting so that you can't have this potpourri of different standards, even though I realize that that's going to be challenging in terms of the tradition of state-oriented voting. And it's true that the Constitution does give states an opportunity to set rules, but we need national rules. And 87% of the people in our poll said that they want national standards for voting. So we're dealing with, again, with a public that's very restless and restive for this.
Since you said voting rights, which was on the top of my list, I will just say more broadly, racial justice, civil rights is really important. I think that that actually connects to a range of other rights that we are talking about or maybe haven't even touched on. In the opening foreword written by Martha Minow, she starts by saying that rights are both ideals and measures of the shortfall of human societies. And I think if we think of the historical legacy of enslavement in this country and the lingering disparities and the effects of discrimination on people of color more generally, but African-Americans and Native Americans more specifically, I do think we need to address these issues. And it's no surprise that actually we are seeing forces that are really not wanting us to study this history in schools or wanting to revise textbooks or muzzle the capacity of libraries. So I would prioritize that issue. And I think that would then also improve other access to other rights as well.
And so I wanted to raise the media environment in the whole world has changed quite dramatically in the last 15 years or so with the rise of social media and in the United States, the decline of traditional professional media and journalism. We have just this last week, probably the world's richest person, Elon Musk, buying one of the most influential social media platforms, Twitter. How does the free speech environment or the speech and information environment affect the realization of rights in your view?
Well, I think enormously, obviously, the whole question of truth. And I mean, how can you have a search for truth in a digital world in which there is a constant opportunity for disinformation? And in the earlier days of the media, of course, or in the heyday of the media in the United States, there was a kind of gatekeeping function of reporting and people who are journalists who were exercising that. Now, basically, everything is open. So what we have is a social media environment in which disinformation is constantly pervaded and can be very widely disseminated. So that, I think, is a problematic issue to address, but it needs to be addressed. And there are ways of doing that, which we could get into. But Sushma may want to add to that.
Yeah, so there are three things I'd like to say about Elon Musk and Twitter. The first is, irrespective of who he is, the fact that you have billionaires controlling all of these large social media platforms, which are no longer purely for entertainment, right? They're for communications, they're for accessing news, they're for building political campaigns. They form a large part of our public sphere. And so that is just one concern, that you have yet another billionaire controlling the space. The second issue was, you know, he had posted on Twitter where he clarified that by free speech, he simply means that which matches the law. He says that he's against censorship that goes far beyond the law. And if that people want less free speech, they will ask government to pass laws to that effect. Therefore, going beyond the law is contrary to the will of the people. So this struck me as particularly naive, if we are relying on governments to pass laws as to what is permissible, then we will find very quickly that in many countries around the world, it will be censorship, right? You cannot criticize the ruling party or the person in power. And then on the flip side, what he will permit really is hate speech that will not be moderated. And this really has a significant impact on women, on people of color, on ethnic minorities, where I think the past kind of interventions that Twitter had in terms of taking down posts and trying to perform some sort of content moderation, albeit after the fact, I think those some of those protections may be affected. And so I do think this raises some questions and alarm bells, but the reality is also that there aren't other platforms right now like Twitter. And how do we think of maintaining these global platforms for communication and connection that also foster civility, respect, and regard for human rights?
So a couple of folks in the Q&A are bringing up the very important challenge that Sushma already pointed to of money, of billionaires and democracy. And so right now in the United States, we certainly have great concentrations of wealth. So where does that leave us with the question of hijacking of democracy?
Well, I think that there's a very direct connection in many ways between the growing economic inequality, which is now greater than it's ever been at any other point in American history, and the sidetracking or hijacking, as we say in the book, of rights. Because it's possible in a system where there's unlimited economic power that can be exercised by individuals, it's possible without regulation for people essentially to buy their way into various policies that they'd prefer to have. So we do have a growing interest, I think, in a regulatory system to guard against that, certainly in the use of money in politics. We also have what I think is a growing potential left, far right, or not even far left, but basically across the political spectrum, coalition of people who are very eager to see a change in the way in which we manage wealth in this country, a way in which the government might address issues of economic inequality. We see this in our poll. In the polls we saw during the pandemic in particular, the interest in what we call economic rights, the right to education, the right to housing, the right to clean air and water, et cetera, the interest in those rights grew substantially, and the expectation that government could do something about them grew substantially. And this is an issue that more people would like to see addressed now.
So in terms of inequality in the U.S., absolutely, I think this is a huge issue, and it really touches on many of the other issues we've been talking about. And inequality is actually rising in the U.S., and it's also higher than in other advanced economies. If we look at the comparison of income inequality, looking at the Gini coefficient, which is basically a number that measures inequality, the U.S. is actually higher than other G7 countries. It's similar in a way to India. So I think this is a source of concern. In addition to income inequality, we also have to think about wealth inequality, which is like the assets that people have and the wealth divide that takes place. And then the one thing I'll flag that connects to the racial justice conversation is the suggestion for reparations, which has been kind of, coming up from time to time. And I do think that is an important conversation to center in this discussion of wealth and income inequality as to how do we deal with like historical legacies of discrimination in order to ensure that institutions are better equipped to deal with these challenges in the future and that people are sort of compensated for, past discrimination and exclusion.
Yeah, it is hard to know what to do about the wealth situation. So, one school of thought says we should build bigger walls between the economic domain where there's big inequality and the political domain where there's supposed to be political equality, one person, one vote. And other people say, well, that will never work because money is like water. This is called the hydraulic theory of money and politics. It's like water, and any dam that you build, money will try to find a way, will find a way to penetrate through. So the only thing you can really do is to level out those inequalities, the great concentrations of wealth in the background there. So there's a lot of questions about money and politics and lobbying that we could, that we need to take up perhaps on another occasion. Perhaps the we can end up with some suggestions about how to move forward. And so a couple of areas on how to move forward. One is, how are we doing on rights education, on people knowing, Americans understanding the rights and responsibilities that they have in civic education? So that's the a broad-based one that I'd like to ask you to address. And the second is the directly on the hijacking of democracy. Is there anything we can do to assure that January 6th won't play out in a more devastating way in 2024 or 2028?
I think the most effective and important way, and I'm nervous that it may not be pursued, that we can make sure that it's made very clear that what happened at the insurrection in the Capitol was not only a violation of the norms of democracy, but a violation of the law. And I think we have prosecutions that are underway of people who participated in the insurrection, but I think those prosecutions need to go all the way up to the top. And I think the only way to make this a clear statement by a democratic system that believes in the rule of law and that that is able to protect itself against insurrection is to prosecute those who sought violently to overthrow the government of the United States. And so that's my answer to that. There are a lot of technical things that could be done, but that's, and I think the forthcoming report of the January 6th committee of the House of Representatives will address this question. And then it, of course, will be before the Justice Department and the Attorney General to make decisions.
Yeah, so I completely agree with John on the issue of prosecutions. I think that is really, really critical for not only for January 6th, but also for the future to show that impunity is not the path. In terms of civic education, I think that's really important. We've touched on these topics before, but I'd also touch civic education in the digital age. We have young people getting online at very young ages, getting on social media, often getting their news through social media. So really thinking about how does one discern what is the truth, what is fake news, how do you not amplify information that is misinformation or disinformation, how do you communicate with others in civil and respectful ways and negotiate differences of perspective respectfully. All of these are really, really critical skills that need to be invested in. The question is, what is the business model for this, given the underfunding of public education? Again, we do not want billionaire philanthropists in the space necessarily controlling this dialogue, but we need to really think about, you know, how do we build a collective and common public sphere that is, you know, characterized by pluralism and respect for rights and tolerance.
Okay, so I'd like to thank today's guests, John Shattuck, Sushma Raman, and Archon Fung for such a good job. Cambridge Forum is made possible through the generosity of Dorothy and Herbert Better, the Lowell Institute, the Cambridge Community Foundation, and you. If you'd like to donate or sign up to our members list, visit our website, www.cambridgeforum.org. Thank you all for taking part.